Ignore paragraph 1. Paragraph 2. The so-called classic organ designed by G. Donald Harrison in the Germanic Museum of Harvard University was really just a lucky accident. Paragraph 3. During the mid-1930s, Harrison had been to Europe in company with Emerson Richards and had listened to a lot of the famous European organs. He had come back with a number of ideas which he wanted to put into practice. Paragraph 4. In those years, business was rather slack for the Aeolian Skinner Company, and Harrison proposed to use some of the free time to plan and build a small organ as a demonstration model, and this was to be put in a small room at the factory. Paragraph 5. The Romanesque Hall of the Germanic Museum, now the Busch Reisinger Museum, is a wonderful place for an organ. It has a high barrel roof and is of stone and concrete construction. There is a gallery at one end and a replica of the Golden Gate of Freiburg Cathedral in Saxony at the other. Paragraph 6. Various people, including King Covell and Ed Gammons, had previously observed that an organ would sound extremely well there. Paragraph 7. I can't quite explain how I came to be walking around the museum, snapping my fingers and thinking the same thoughts, but I suppose it was because I had just been fired from the job at Christchurch, Cambridge. Being fired is a very good stimulant any time. Paragraph 8. I took the rather large liberty of suggesting the idea of an organ to Dr. Charles Kuhn, K-U-H-N, curator of the museum. He was very sympathetic, but of course remarked that there was no money available. Paragraph 9. I also went to see Dr. Paul Sachs and Dr. Edward Forbes at the Fogg Museum. They too were equally enthusiastic, but had no suggestions as to where money might come from. Paragraph 10. So it was really just a most fortunate coincidence of several factors that I was able to suggest to Donald Harrison and Bill Zoik, who was vice president of Aeolian Skinner, why not put that organ in the Germanic Museum, at any rate, say for a year, on loan, see how it sounds. It would certainly sound much better than in the small room at the factory. Paragraph 11. Fortunately, Dr. Kuhn was agreeable and adventurous. It involved removing an ancient boat that had occupied the gallery, but he did not consider this an obstacle. Paragraph 12. The organ was put in 1937. It had two manuals and pedals, totally unenclosed, though chicken wire was all around to prevent the students helping themselves to the pipes. The specification, of course, is on paper. Wind chests and pipes, I understand, were largely made out of odds and ends lying around the factory. However, some of the pipes doubtless were new, incorporating Harrison's recently acquired ideas. The console was from an ancient Aeolian player organ with the player mechanism removed. It had 8 general pistons, blind, which one adjusted by a contact board. Stops were controlled by tablets on either side of the console, and a row of tablets above the keyboard controlled the couplers. Paragraph 13. All in all, the organ was quite playable. It sounded extraordinarily well. Bright tone, outgoing, very persuasive. Of course, the bland voicing did not give the organ any articulation, and the electric action would have precluded any control of CHIF, had there been any CHIF. As a whole, the ensemble sounded very well when the hall was empty. When the hall had people in it, and the acoustics were cut down, one tended to hear the mutations as separate lines. But at the time, these limitations were not so apparent. One rejoiced in the forward-sounding tone, unhampered by enclosure. It took a little while for the lessons, both positive and negative, taught by the instrument to be learned. Still, all in all, the effect in the museum was new and striking. Paragraph 15. Ernest White, Ed Gammons played it. Also Lady Jeans, who happened to be over here with Sir James Jeans at that time. We have an amusing memory of Sir James leaning over the side gallery and leading the applause. Marcel Dupré played it. He didn't like it. Also Fritz Heitmann played it just before the war in a wonderful Bach program. Lots of people came to hear it, filling all corners of the museum, more or less to the dismay of Dr. Kuhn, who was all too well aware of fire laws concerning the allowable size of audiences and the number of exits. I was fortunate to give a number of concerts on the organ, including the Bach Organ Works, and the first performance in this country of Poulenc's new organ concerto, which the composer was kind enough to play for me when he was in New York, playing with the New York Philharmonic. Also concertos of Handel, Corelli, William Felton, and other composers. Charles O'Connell, music director of Victor Records, on one of his many visits to Boston to record the Boston Symphony, came over to hear the organ. He was immediately fascinated with it and proposed recordings of Bach, Dakin, Felton, and Handel. So after recording the Boston Symphony one day, Victor brought over their machines. These were the old wind-ups. They had heavy weights, which had to be cranked up, and which, in their downward fall, turned the cutting table. Needles cut into a heavy platter of soft wax. You had one go at playing the piece, and just possibly a second or third. But that was that. You had to choose. And you heard no playback, for to play the wax would have been to ruin it for later pressing. James Fassett, music director of the Columbia Broadcasting System, who was heard every Sunday afternoon at 3 as commentator for the New York Philharmonic program, and who directed Invitation to Music, School of the Air, and other programs, became interested in some broadcasts from the Germanic Museum. With the generous interest and support of Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge, noted music patroness of Washington and Cambridge, we started on a series of 10 programs, half-hour programs broadcast at 9:15 on Sunday morning. They went coast to coast on the CBS network. The first one was in September 1942. The organ had, of course, been in by then for several years. The original loan for 1 year had been extended for another year, then to another year, and then to another year. Paragraph 22. By 1942, the war was on. and the Germanic Museum, being such a splendidly substantial building, had been taken over by the U.S. Army. It was at first a school for army chaplains, and later for the training of army officers in foreign languages. Fortunately, the broadcasts were allowed to go on week by week. Paragraph 51. With the army in possession, public concerts were at that time no longer possible. And in fact, concerts actually attracted too many people, breaking the fire and occupancy laws. In this particular way, the broadcasts were an absolute godsend because they enabled the organ and its music to reach out to many people right across the country, to the Yukon, and by shortwave radio, even to Europe. Paragraph 23. Music played on this organ seemed to interest the critics. The Boston papers, Time magazine, and other journals occasionally reviewed the concerts and published feature articles. The Harvard poet David McCord published a most generous poem, which appeared in the New Yorker. Paragraph 24. About 1939, this is going back a bit now, the new shed at Tanglewood had been completed for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. In the next season, Dr. Koussevitzky planned to give the Bach B minor Mass, and he refused to be satisfied with the prospect of an electronic imitation organ for the continuo, that is the organ part. George Judd, incidentally, bully for Koussevitzky. George Judd, the Boston Symphony manager, inquired what would be possible for a real organ at Tanglewood. As a result, one Saturday afternoon, I took Dr. Koussevitzky in my Model A Ford, purchase price, second hand, $75, to hear the Germanic Museum organ. He was delighted. He said, in effect, "Fine, send the organ up to Tanglewood." Well, it was explained to him that the Germanic organ wasn't being offered as a gift, it wasn't for sale, and anyway, it wouldn't fit the Tanglewood shed. But the net result was that a rather similar organ was commissioned by the Boston trustees for Tanglewood. And despite 30 or more freezing Berkshire winters, this organ, built by Donald Harrison, has given excellent service to this day. Returning now to 1942, 43, 44, the broadcasts continued year by year, and they didn't come to an end, incidentally, until 1958 in September. They seemed to gather momentum. CBS gave a small budget for instrumentalists. In 1944 and 45, I gave first performances of Prelude and Allegro by Walter Piston, the Classic Concerto by Leo Sowerby, both written for the broadcasts, the Chorale for Organ and Brass by Roy Harris, which he himself conducted, two trio sonatas by Daniel Pinkham, a work by Quincy Porter, Fantasy, all those also written for the program. Also performances of the Hindemith, Poulenc, Hanson, and other concertos, and many works, both classic and a few modern, for solo instruments, violin, English horn, oboe, etc., with organ. Paragraph 26. All broadcasts until the very last in 1958 were live, and they had to be practiced and pre-timed almost to the second, though theme At the end of the program, Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze could take up the slack, provided there wasn't too much of it. The announcer and engineer were right there in the gallery. The announcer leaning on the console with his script, and the engineer just by watching the signal level. The program was relayed over a telephone line to WEEI in Boston, and then to New York, and then put on the network. Paragraph 27. An amusing incident happened 1 week. At the change in the year from daylight to suntime, when everyone loses an hour. A 0 hour for the program came, but there was no announcer. In the emergency, Peggy had to read the script. She met the challenge with aplomb and got us off on the dot. This is the CBS radio network, which was the cue line. But the final result was a handful of letters to CBS protesting lady announcers. Amusingly, the CBS announcer had been right outside the front door of the museum all the time, sitting in his car. But although he had been announcing the time change for several hours on the radio, he had omitted to change his own watch and thought he had another hour to spare. Paragraph 28. Other emergencies occurred around 1943 or 44. Despite the enormous publicity G. Donald Harrison was receiving week by week, he found that the Aeolian Skinner Company was short of money. Times were admittedly hard for organ builders, prevented from normal building by government war regulations, and Harrison announced that if somebody didn't buy the organ, he positively would take it out and sell it. Shotgun sale, as it was arranged, and the organ could then remain indefinitely in the museum. Paragraph 29. Other guests playing on the broadcast through this period included Daniel Pinkham, Lawrence Moe, Claire Cochie, and Carl Richter. On the broadcast at about this time was heard the first performance of Ives' Variations on America. Charles Ives had generously sent me a copy of his manuscript through his wife Harmony, and of course he had played it himself when he improvised and presumably wrote it down on July the 4th, 1891, in a little church in Brewster, New York. The manuscript appears to have been lying in a corner of his Connecticut barn for every one of the 50 years intervening. At that time, when he wrote America, Ives was 16 years old. The manuscript bears the initials in the margin of H.R.S., Harry Rose Shelley, who was evidently his teacher at Yale, or at any rate in New Haven. Harry Rose Shelley has some pithy comments and exclamation marks about Ives' liberties with the tonality, consecutive fifths, consecutive octaves, and so on. Paragraph 31. The 6 double concertos by the Spanish composer Antonio Sola were also heard for the first U.S. time. I had been fortunate to be sent the manuscripts, that is, of course, photostats of the manuscripts, before their publication. I pre-recorded one part, which was for the broadcast, played into the circuit, and while listening to it on earphones, I added the other part live. It was a hazardous undertaking, but it seemed to come off. Many letters would arrive from all over. One typical and very interesting correspondent was a man called Hugh Birch. He lived in the Yukon. He would hear the program because of the distance at about 4 o'clock in the morning, temperature perhaps 50 below zero. His comments were always interesting. He loved trumpet music. And for example, he would write and say, "That was a magnificent Krebs choral prelude that Voisin played with you last Sunday." Commonplace as the scope of radio had become, the whole thing still seemed unreal that it reached so far. And then Hugh Birch was a telephone line man. His job was to look after many miles of overhead wires and keep them functioning, come what may, in the way of weather. He lived by himself. He was a genial chap. He enclosed a picture of his cat, and underneath he wrote, "My cat so-and-so, better company than many humans." As mentioned before, the broadcasts were played live. Dr. Kuhn was kind enough to allow a small audience on Sunday mornings, about 30 people, not enough to dampen the valuable acoustics. They sat under the Golden Gate at the other end of the hall. Paragraph 33. Broadcasts continued steadily through the 40s and into the 50s. But in 1954, our ears became stretched, to use Charles Ives' phrase. I had the privilege of going to Europe to play concerts from far north Trondheim Cathedral right down through Scandinavia, Holland, Germany, Austria, and even to Spain and Portugal. Playing the great historic organs of Europe had for me the impact of a revelation. For the first time, I became aware of the enormous reservoir, the sum total of the art of the organ in its building and tonal aspects from 5 or 6 centuries. Paragraph 34. The sound of these instruments was so enormously different and superior to what we were accustomed to. And the instruments, despite their age and the different playing dimensions of the console and pedal board, were so much more responsive. Paragraph 35. Many things thus suddenly came into focus. The importance of tracker action, of articulate voicing, of the organ case, of the wind chest, and so on and so on. And particularly the complete interaction of playing action and pipe sound. Paragraph 36. One suddenly realized the truth and enormous vitality of all that Schweitzer had written about many years before. Everyone reads his books and his pamphlets about the organs, but the truth of all that he says doesn't percolate until you hear, and preferably play, these older organs. By the fortunate fact that we were able to bring back from the 1954 tour on tape, bring them back aloud, to misquote Frank Buck, and then put onto a record, The Art of the Organ, these sounds, they could be fixed for rehearing and re-examination. Paragraph 38. Another trip next year down the Mozart Trail, playing as many as possible of the organs Mozart played, and he played the organ just about wherever he went, as you can read in his collected letters, made it imperative that we should have a different sort of organ in the Germanic Museum, by now renamed the Busch Reisinger Museum. Paragraph 39. We had to have an organ made according to the old basic principles 100%, with the sonority and controllability of the older organs. Paragraph 40. A new organ was therefore planned to be built by D.A. Flanthrop of Zaandam, Holland. It was to be of 3 manuals of 27 apparent stops, but actually 30, as explained later. And this new Flanthrop organ was installed in the summer of 1958. Paragraph 41. While the Aeolian Skinner organ spread right across the back of the gallery, with the console detached, the Flanthrop organ stood in the center, to the front of the gallery, the positive jutting over, and the console naturally was part of the instrument. Paragraph 42. Flanthrop gave much thought to design and voicing the organ, even to the extent of sending over and setting up one of his 6-stop organs as a trial balloon, so to speak. The little organ, very bold and articulate, sounded simply wonderful, standing in the side gallery because the Aeolian Skinner was still in the main gallery. It kept the Skinner Organ Company for a number of months, while the larger organ was being built in Holland. As a matter of fact, the merits and authoritative impact of those 6 wonderfully voiced sets of Flanthrop pipes in his little organ, plus tracker action, were such a startling contrast to the Aeolian Skinner that we hardly let anyone hear the small little instrument for fear that nobody later on would be interested in purchasing the Aeolian Skinner. Paragraph 43. This is going back to the year 1949. In that summer, Albert Schweitzer visited Cambridge. He played several organs, the one at the Church of the Advent at Memorial Church, Harvard, and of course he came to the Germanic Museum. He wouldn't play a public concert, he wouldn't give a broadcast, but for friends he played all 3 of these organs. He seemed to enjoy playing, and it was in fact hard to get him to stop. He had lunch and other appointments, and we had practically to peel him off the organ bench to get him there. He didn't make any particular comment on the organs. He just didn't say anything. Paragraph 44. Another visitor to the Aeolian Skinner organ was Walt Disney. I played a Dakar Noël for him. He seemed to enjoy it, but he didn't find any use for it with Mickey Mouse. It seemed to impress visitors to the Aeolian Skinner organ that really quite a lot of unlikely music could be played on it, quite successfully. The Franck chorales, Liszt, even the Reibke Sonata. And they were surprised that a full and musical effect could be achieved with so few stops. Well, the organ served a great purpose in showing people this, I think. No one, to my recollection, ever mentioned the absence of a swell pedal. They just didn't seem to notice the lack of it. Paragraph 46. When we gave broadcasts with orchestra, players were strung, Indian fashion, one behind the other, squeezed in the narrow space between the front of the organ and the gallery railing. Arthur Fiedler, standing right by me, had a podium about 1 yard square. He never fell off it. Paragraph 47. There was a lot of distinguished playing by Alfred Zegera on the viola da gamba and the Boston Society of Ancient Instruments. Louis Speyer, playing the English horn and oboe. Emil Kornsan, violinist of the Boston Symphony, who also wrote an organ piece that came out the same way, whether you played it forwards or backwards. His music begins, tightens to a central point, and then unravels note for note. To John Festerman, do you think this is the best beginning? Paragraph 48. The classic organ in the Germanic Museum of Harvard University, Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is now just a pile of burnt wood and melted metal, was really in the beginning just a lucky accident. The organ referred to is not, of course, the present Flenthrop, but the previous instrument by G. Donald Harrison of Aeolian Skinner. Here are just a few more items. Paragraph 49. Among the conductors appearing on the broadcasts and in concerts for that matter were Richard Bergin, associate conductor of the Boston Symphony. Also Bernard Herrmann, I guess, of CBS, who regularly conducted Invitation to Music. And James Fassett himself came up here with Ben Higham's commentator to produce a number of special shows for hours other than at 9:15. Paragraph 50. Another amusing incident occurred in the early 50s, I guess. I was playing at the Bach Festival in Bethlehem, which is held on a Saturday, and I got caught in the railroad strike. I came back by overnight sleeper, but waking up on Sunday morning, instead of being in South Station in Boston, I was just stuck in the yard somewhere. And I never did get to that broadcast. I don't know what happened that day. I think they had music on an electronic organ. Here are a few possible items that I should send you on paper. The specification of the Aeolian Skinner, which of course you know, and the specification of the Flenthrop, which of course you also know. Then there are pictures of the old organ, pictures of the hall, pictures of the Golden Gate, and certainly the pictures of Albert Schweitzer, Donald Harrison, and others at the instrument. Paragraph 57, a few more remarks. One very useful feature of the Aeolian Skinner was its adaptability to accompanying solo instruments, the oboe, the bassoon, violin, English horn, and so on. The 8-foot stops, and particularly the 8 and 2 foot, were very light, ideal for such continuo use. Paragraph 58. When the Flenthrop organ came to be built, some disposition of the Aeolian Skinner had to be made. It went, as you know, to Boston University and was set up in their new concert hall on Commonwealth Avenue, Boston. Though the acoustical conditions were not as favorable as the Busch Reisinger, the organ still sounded very well indeed. It was grand anyway that it was still in circulation, in constant use by students and reaching listeners. Paragraph 59. Ironically, soon after the Flenthrop organ arrived and was set up, the radio programs were terminated. TV was pushing network radio off the map. The New York Philharmonic, Invitation to Music, Invitation to Learning, School of the Air, all these programs were dropped. Practically all creative, that is, live music, was dropped. Local radio stations became merely parasites on the record industry, which of course is a purely static state of affairs. Paragraph 60. But as one avenue closed, another opened up, namely more and more LP records, particularly stereo. The moment radio was finished, Columbia Records, fortunately, were marching in with their equipment. No wind-up machines now, but a complex of equipment that occupied a large part of the cellar. In its new home in Boston University, the Aeolian Skinner organ came to a sad end, as you know. It was in the concert hall, and in the spring of 1971, it was the victim of arson. I don't know the details, no doubt Aeolian Skinner does, and I believe they have what remains of the instrument. Let's hope it can be rejuvenated and placed once again in a favorable acoustical environment. At any rate, it lived its life, 1937 to 1971, in a period when it was possible for its musical influence to be the greatest. For myself, I'm enormously grateful to G. Donald Harrison, to Dr. Charles Kuhn, to James Fassett and others for all the wonderful opportunity that the instrument represented. You probably already know about the three convertible stops that lie in their boxes available for use with the Flenthrop organ. By taking out the pipes and putting in the others, you can convert the dual duty 2-foot stop on the grate, which is half principal, half flute, to a real, honest to goodness, principal 2-foot. And then with the Brustberg, you can lift out the 8-foot ranquette and you can replace it with a 2-foot Shalmai, which is really more useful played by pedal coupler, as in Bach's Rejoice Ye Christians. Or you can take those pipes out and you can put in an 8-foot Dulcian, which makes a nice contrast, a rather thinner sound, to the 8-foot Krumhorn. The older Holtkamp, when I told him about this and these three convertible stops that Flenthrop was making, he said, "Oh my God, don't tell organists about that, or every organist would want half a dozen convertible stops like spare tires with his new instrument." Changing the pipes and retuning them, of course, involves a certain amount of trouble, but these convertible stops have been rather useful, and they've added additional color to the organ.